Cat Cora's journey from a small-town Mississippi kitchen to culinary stardom reads like a Hollywood script. Born in 1967 and adopted at just 1 week old, this trailblazing chef would eventually shatter glass ceilings as the first female Iron Chef. Her memoir, Cooking as Fast as I Can, has become required reading in culinary schools nationwide, with celebrity chefs like Gordon Ramsay and Padma Lakshmi citing it as one of their favorite culinary memoirs. Beyond its culinary insights, the book has been praised for its honest portrayal of identity, addiction, and resilience, earning it recognition from LGBTQ+ advocacy groups and addiction recovery communities. What makes this story so compelling isn't just Cora's professional achievements, but her raw honesty about the personal struggles that shaped her journey from a small-town kitchen to international culinary fame. Growing up in Jackson, Mississippi in the 1960s and 70s, my childhood was a unique blend of Southern American and Greek traditions. Our backyard on Swan Lake Drive opened into endless piney woods, where my brothers and I built forts and cut down Christmas trees. Though we were latchkey kids with working parents, we were deeply loved. My mother, Virginia, packed our lunches daily, and my father, Spiro, would watch over us from his lazy boy when he returned from teaching. My parents were remarkably progressive for 1960s Mississippi. While Dad studied history and Mom worked as a nursing supervisor, they daringly invited African-American friends to their parties, risking their home being burned down. On Swan Lake Drive, they got along with everyone: the Southern Baptist family, the Yankee family, the Black family, and the gay couple across the street whom Mom adored. Every Thanksgiving, our home welcomed people of all backgrounds. They all bleed red, my mother would say. The most distinctive aspect of my upbringing was our family's fusion cuisine, blending Greek traditions from my father's side with Southern influences. Dad was born just after his family arrived in Mississippi from Skopelos, Greece, bringing recipes from my favorite dish, kota kapama, chicken with onions, garlic, cinnamon, and tomato paste. They also introduced us to horia tiki salad, spanako pita, moussaka, and galakto bureko dessert. In 1960s Mississippi, Greek ingredients like kalamata olives and feta had to be shipped from Chicago. Meanwhile, my mom contributed sweet and sour pork, lasagna, and enchiladas to our table. Their fusion cooking produced unique combinations like grits with feta and southern greens finished with Greek olive oil. Greeks dominated Jackson's fine dining scene by the late 1960s, owning all but two upscale restaurants. My grandfather, Pete Cora, settled in Greenville in 1935 and opened the Coney Island Cafe, choosing an American-sounding name after our family name was shortened from Caragiosas at Ellis Island. Another influential figure was godfather Pete Costas, called Taki, who owned the Continental restaurant where my parents met. The Continental was magical to me as a child. Red leather booths, bustling waitstaff, the aromas of seared fish and grilled steak, and a glamorous cloud of cigarette smoke hanging over the dining room. Even as a child, I showed early signs of culinary interest. In grade school, I developed a love for tea parties and baking, hosting friends with homemade cookies and eventually graduating to an easy-bake oven. I even held neighborhood bake sales, selling vanilla cakes with chocolate frosting for 5 cents each. Though I had only one regular customer, a boy named Mark, who kept coming back for more, I was learning the fundamentals of running a restaurant: create excellent, consistent food and treat customers well. The adoption that began my life was never a secret. My mother's scrapbook clearly marked, "Born April 3rd, 1967. Adopted April 10, 1967. When I turned 21, I learned my mother had contacted the Mississippi Children's Home after I'd asked about my health history years earlier. My birth mother, Joanne, had called the home every year on my birthday hoping to connect with me. Mom had written to her, and Joanne had responded, sharing that she was a registered nurse, like my mother, and had two children. On my 21st birthday, Mom presented me with these letters. Though initially upset they hadn't told me sooner, I called Joanne the next morning. A week later, my parents, grandmother, and I went to meet her at the children's home. The moment she walked in, we fell into each other's arms. We looked remarkably alike, both petite, with the same hands and mannerisms. Joanne shared her story. Pregnant at 15 by a 20-year-old drummer named Knox, she was sent away, eventually giving birth to me at 16. Despite Knox's family's rejection when we visited his hometown years later, my parents encouraged my relationship with Joanne and her family, showing extraordinary grace in supporting this connection. My journey of self-discovery extended beyond my adoption story to my sexuality. The summer between my junior and senior year was transformative. Working as a lifeguard at the YMCA, I met Jordan, a stunning blonde cheerleader who swam at the pool daily. What started as breakdancing lessons at her house evolved into my first real romantic experience. Unlike with Johnny, my steady boyfriend, kissing Jordan made me feel like a human sparkler, every inch of me bright and crackling. We maintained the appearance of intense friendship while secretly dating. Throughout high school, I thrived in extracurricular activities like the Wingfield Follies, Student Council, and the prestigious Gentiles Drill Team, developing teamwork skills that would later serve me in professional kitchens. I dated Johnny throughout high school, though I already knew I preferred girls, but assumed I would follow the traditional Southern path of marrying a man and having children. After high school, I continued to struggle with my identity. After quitting bodybuilding, I found a new gym focused on overall fitness where I met Blake, tall, blonde, and bursting with energy, everything I liked in a woman. Our romance accelerated quickly, becoming inseparable almost immediately. When Blake came out to her conservative family and broke up with her Christian boyfriend, Edward, he showed up at our gym and punched her in the face. Shortly after, I lost my job at another gym when my boss questioned me about being gay. These early experiences with discrimination and identity struggles would shape my approach to life and career, instilling a resilience that would serve me well in the competitive culinary world I would later enter. Despite my love for food and cooking, my path to a culinary career wasn't straightforward. After graduating from the University of Southern Mississippi with a degree in exercise physiology and biology, I moved back in with my parents, unsure of my direction. Planning to backpack through Europe, I needed money and landed a job at Jackson's Top Restaurant. Starting as a waitress, I found myself drawn to the kitchen during slow periods, fascinated by the chef's ability to multitask confidently and create beautiful dishes from memory, unlike my recipe-dependent home cooking. In the kitchen, I found peace during troubled times. Cooking became my sanctuary. When I focused solely on food preparation, everything inside me settled. I often cooked for my godparents, Taki and Maria, with Taki sharing techniques he'd learned in Lyon, France during World War II. He taught me to cure salmon, make Lyonnaise dressing, and prepare perfectly roasted chicken. A pivotal moment came when I entered a cooking competition called Taste of Elegance in Jackson. To my shock, I won against experienced male chefs, with legendary chef Paul Prudhomme as the judge. This victory confirmed I was on the right path, though my daily routine remained unchanged as I continued perfecting my craft. I idolized Tulia Child, having watched The French Chef as a child with my brother Chris. When I had the chance to meet her at a book signing, I brought my mom and grandmother along. After waiting in line, I simply told her, "I want to cook." Julia immediately advised me to attend the Culinary Institute of America, calling it the Harvard of Culinary Schools. She encouraged me, but warned that the culinary world was brutal, competitive, and a man's world, urging me to be stubborn and intractable in your determination. At 26, I packed my Honda, a gift from my grandmother when she stopped driving, and headed to Hyde Park, New York, to attend the Culinary Institute of America. The journey north was eye-opening. I'd never been north before, having lived my entire life in Mississippi. Hyde Park felt cold and formal, with silvery light and industrial smells instead of magnolias. My first weeks were a blur of orientation, uniform lectures, and toolkit issuance. I felt completely out of place. My Taste of Elegance victory now seemed embarrassingly naive compared to my classmates' knowledge. After initially withdrawing from the program and returning to Mississippi, I got a job at Jackson's University Club, where the executive sous chef, Paul, a CIA graduate, took me under his wing. A year later, I returned to CIA with newfound confidence. I wasn't perfect, but I was focused. I shaved the sides of my head to keep my hair neat under my toque, a trend my female classmates soon adopted. I threw myself into extracurriculars, becoming vice president of both the Epicures of Wine Club and Gourmet Society, and co-editing a student cookbook called KitchenAid. For my required summer externship, I secured a position at Anne Rosenzweig's celebrated Arcadia restaurant in Manhattan and championed American cuisine with creative twists, lobster club sandwiches, arugula Caesar salads, and corn cakes with creme fraiche. Her flair for plating would later influence my Iron Chef presentations. In early 1995, I graduated from the Culinary Institute with honors at the top of my class. Following graduation, I embarked on a European apprenticeship, working with renowned chefs in France. This experience was transformative, exposing me to traditional techniques and the reverence Europeans hold for ingredients. During this time, I also visited Skopelos, Greece, where my ancestors lived. There, I experienced a profound realization about food's universal power to connect people across language barriers, inspiring me to pursue cooking professionally with renewed purpose. Upon returning to America, I faced unemployment and financial struggles. At 30, with only $800 in savings and $900 in overdue rent, I was desperate. My parents had instilled in me that unemployment was shameful. Do not go on the dole, my mother had warned. For 3 months, I sent resumes and pounded pavement. When I was down to one meal a day, I finally applied for unemployment. Robin, my therapist, called to check on me after I'd canceled our sessions. When I explained I couldn't afford therapy, she proposed a trade: cooking lessons for therapy sessions. In her kitchen, we made roast chicken while discussing my susceptibility to manipulation, then created stock from the carcass while examining how my childhood sexual abuse had affected me. As we prepared Greek chickpea soup, we explored the additional trauma of my parents' inadequate response to the abuse. When I was nearly destitute, Michael Chiarello called with a restaurant opportunity in Lafayette, California's East Bay. A fellow culinary graduate with numerous awards, Michael offered me the executive chef position at Postino Italian for Postman, housed in a beautiful 1937 former post office with brick walls, an atrium entrance, and personal fire pits on the patio. Opening in May 1998, Postino was an immediate hit. I created a playful, sophisticated menu featuring crisp onion rings with spicy mayo, handmade mozzarella with heirloom tomatoes, and garganelli pasta with braised rabbit and wild mushrooms. California was a revelation, green, balmy, with sunny days and crisp nights. The Napa Valley was at the cutting edge of American cuisine, with Thomas Keller's French Laundry nearby and Alice Waters' Chez Panis just 38 miles south. When Jacques Pepin visited Bistro Don Giovanni, where I later worked, I prepared my signature whole fish and sides. He loved it, squeezing my hand and telling me it was the best meal he'd had on tour. 2 weeks later, he sent a letter to the James Beard Foundation recommending they invite me to cook at the James Beard House, a significant honor that would advance my career. Despite professional successes, I continued to face challenges in various kitchen environments. Working for Donna at Bistro Don Giovanni had significant downsides. She was legendary for her fiery temper throughout Napa Valley. Though she hired me as executive chef so she could focus on the business, she often undermined my authority with the brigade she'd worked with for 10 years. Our relationship was complicated and operatic. She could be extremely generous, but also controlling and critical. My television career began unexpectedly when Joey Altman, a well-known chef who hosted the local cooking show Bay Cafe, invited me to appear on his program after seeing me at the Taste of San Francisco event. Though I'd never aspired to be a TV star, I discovered a natural aptitude for on-camera cooking. The challenge of working with food while describing my process and remaining entertaining felt exhilarating, like juggling while riding a unicycle. After sending my Bay Cafe tape to the Food Network, which was actively seeking new talent, I received an invitation to appear on In Food Today as a Southern chef. This led to 4 appearances on Ready, Set, Cook, where I competed against Chef to the Stars, Randall Andrews. Before I could even leave the studio, an executive named Bob Tushman approached me about auditioning for another show. The Food Network paired me with Rocco Disparito on The Melting Pot, representing Mediterranean cuisine. Rocco was already a culinary star, having received accolades from Ruth Reichel in the New York Times and Best New Chef honors from major publications. Though I prided myself on adapting quickly to television cooking, next to Rocco, I was completely green. While I aimed for natural authenticity, he understood that television required a different kind of TV natural, the sweet spot where serious cooking meets entertainment. By this point, Food Network executives recognized that I wasn't just a Mississippi girl cooking Southern comfort food, but a chef with deep Greek culinary roots. They invited me to film an episode of My Country, My Kitchen, sending me to Skopolis to capture my Aunt Demetra and Uncle Yorgios' annual Greek Easter feast. The local East Bay newspaper offered me a column called Cooking from the Hep after seeing me on television. Its popularity led to a feature called Chef's Surprise, where I'd arrive at readers' homes to create meals using only ingredients they already had. Book agent Doe Coover called to ask if I'd considered writing a cookbook, something I'd long dreamed of doing. 2 years later, in 2004, Cat Cora's Kitchen would be published by Chronicle Books. The James Beard Foundation invited me to cook one of their prestigious dinners, a significant honor for any rising chef in 2002. Despite the considerable expense and logistical challenges of bringing my own brigade, ingredients, and equipment to New York, I created an elaborate spring wine country dinner featuring fresh pulled mozzarella, Napa lamb chop scottadita, and rhubarb and strawberry bomboloni. While on a book tour for Cat Cora's Kitchen, I received a life-changing call from Bruce Seidel at Food Network. Do you want to be our first female Iron Chef? After accepting without hesitation, I was shocked to learn my first battle would be in just 2 weeks. My first battle pitted me against Alex Lee, executive chef at Daniel. With Laurelin as my sous chef, I faced the dramatic secret ingredient reveal through billowing dry ice fog, potatoes of all varieties. Though nervous, I embraced the challenge, and the entire hour-long cooking competition passed in an adrenaline-fueled blur. As the first female Iron Chef, I constantly faced gendered commentary, especially when battling other women. These competitions felt particularly high stakes. There seemed to be room for only one female Iron Chef, making these battles about livelihood, not just ego. Off camera, I felt alienated from the boys' club atmosphere. Male chefs and executives formed easy bonds through shared activities I wasn't included in. Even a high-ranking lesbian Food Network executive never offered support, leaving me feeling like the token female, invited but not truly included. With my growing fame came opportunities to expand beyond television into restaurants and product lines. I was determined to create a restaurant that reflected everything I believed in, a place that offered sophisticated food and wine for adults while keeping kids happy. Cuisina at Disney's Boardwalk featured an open kitchen with marble surrounds and gleaming copper pots hanging from the ceiling. The menu balanced accessibility with authenticity, from steel-cut cinnamon oatmeal and blueberry-orange pancakes at breakfast to Saganaki flambéed tableside, spanakopita, kota kapama, and my dad's Greek salad at dinner. Beyond restaurants, I developed multiple business ventures: airport restaurants, a gourmet market, food lines, a cookware line, and even a shoe line. I opened my first international restaurant in Singapore and landed a co-hosting role on Bravo's Around the World in 80 Plates with Curtis Stone. The show took us to 10 countries across 4 continents in 44 days with a crew of nearly 100 people. Amid my Iron Chef success, Hurricane Katrina devastated Mississippi and Louisiana in 2005. Through Chefs for Humanity, an organization I'd founded after the Indian Ocean tsunami, I rallied chef friends, including Tyler Florence and Ming Tsai, to provide emergency relief. We established a kitchen in a Gulfport Elementary School cafeteria, producing 3,000 to 5,000 meals daily for citizens and emergency workers. In Gulfport, the devastation was overwhelming. The tidal surge had penetrated half a mile inland, leaving mountains of debris where streets once stood. Our kitchen operated 24/7, using food rescued from destroyed restaurants whose owners had salvaged their inventory with refrigerator trucks. We had everything from lobsters to pizza dough, creating comforting meals for traumatized people. In early 2010, I received a call from Father Alex Karlatsos of the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of America with an invitation to cook for President Obama and Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou at a White House Greek Independence Day celebration. I created an elaborate menu featuring Greek-inspired dishes, from salt-roasted beet tartar to baby lamb chops with feta chimichurri. After the meal, we met the President and First Lady, who complimented the grape leaves and lamb chops. My greatest joy was having my parents there, Greek Americans and proud Democrats who'd worked to elect Obama. Jennifer and I met at Lake Tahoe and fell in love at first sight. After dating for a year and a half, I proposed beneath the sparkling Eiffel Tower with champagne and brie. Despite only being able to register as domestic partners in California, we had a full wedding with 125 guests at Trevena in Napa on June 30, 2001, both of us in white gowns with veils and a proper wedding party. We decided to start a family after buying a townhouse in Fairfield. At 36, my biological clock was ticking, and we wanted four children. We first explored adoption, but every agency rejected us once they learned we were wives, not sisters or friends. Even the Mississippi Children's Home that had placed me with my parents refused us. We turned to in vitro fertilization, carefully selecting a Greek-American sperm donor who was smart, athletic, artistic, and had retired from donation. After Jennifer conceived, we purchased all his remaining sperm to ensure our future children would share the same biological father. Jennifer gave birth to our first son, Zoran, on October 24, 2003, and I was struck by the overwhelming love and responsibility I felt holding him for the first time. We eventually had four sons, Zoran, Kajay, Thatcher, and Nash. Despite having everything I'd dreamed of, a thriving culinary career, beautiful wife, four healthy children, and a house overlooking the ocean, I'd never felt so depleted. My mission to be the best chef, restaurateur, iron chef, boss, wife, and mother was killing me. In hotel rooms, I'd drink myself into tears, hugging pillows as if they were my babies. In 2010, Jennifer discovered hot yoga and quickly escalated from attending classes three times weekly to twice daily sessions in 105-degree heat. As Jennifer drifted further away, she announced her desire to become a yoga instructor, requiring 9 weeks away from home. This led to extensive couples counseling and growing tension. Our connection withered to sharing only the children and a house key. By Father's Day 2012, Jennifer and I were still struggling. We attempted a lunch date at Cold Spring Tavern, where I had several drinks while Jennifer drove. After a fierce argument, I made the terrible decision to drive after drinking and rear-ended another car. I was arrested with a blood alcohol level twice the legal limit, pled no contest, and received 3 years probation with a $2,386 fine. Getting that DUI was the most shameful moment of my life, but became a wake-up call. I've since recognized my pattern of self-medicating with alcohol to manage trauma from childhood abuse, PTSD, anxiety, and career stress. Though I haven't completely surrendered to recovery, I've sworn never to drink and drive again. My father's illness and death in 2011 brought both grief and healing. After recovering from bladder cancer and visiting us in Santa Barbara for Easter, a golf ball-sized tumor appeared on his neck. Despite my grief, I focused on making every moment count, especially with him enjoying his grandsons. During this difficult time, I was seeing a new therapist to address childhood trauma resurfacing as PTSD. When I asked my parents to join me in therapy, they agreed without hesitation. During our emotional session, we discussed the childhood abuse I'd experienced. My father, struggling to explain his reaction at the time, admitted he handled it badly. He wasn't abandoning me, just stunned and human. Later, my parents confronted my abuser when he unexpectedly visited them, demanding accountability for his actions. This confrontation helped heal me, showing their love and commitment to making things right. For my parents' 50th wedding anniversary, I arranged special surprises despite my father's request for a small gathering. Roses from Oprah, an autographed photo from Barbra Streisand, a special recording from country singer Steve Azar, artwork from Duff Goldman, a letter from the Obamas, and a phone call with Garrison Keillor. I've learned to better manage my schedule, no longer automatically saying yes to every opportunity out of fear. After years of working to distance myself from the confused, abused little girl I once was, I've adopted the mantra, being you is enough. My marriage with Jennifer continues to heal day by day. I got a Rumi tattoo to honor forgiveness. Out beyond ideas of wrongdoing and rightdoing, there is a field. I will meet you there. Today, I'm cooking dinner while Jennifer is at yoga. She finally earned her teaching certificate in Core Power. Our boys help in the kitchen, Zoran making Greek salad, Kahe arranging crackers, Nash and Thatcher playfully eating them. Like my mother, I insist they try everything once and offer them choices about meals. Despite my mistakes, these children are my greatest achievement. As I prepare my favorite kapama, I work siga siga, slowly, slowly, just as the Greeks say. My journey from a small-town Mississippi kitchen to international culinary fame has been filled with triumphs and challenges. Through it all, cooking has remained my sanctuary, a place where I can create order from chaos, nourishment from raw ingredients, and connection across all boundaries. What began as a childhood love of tea parties and bake sales has evolved into a career that has broken barriers and created a legacy that extends far beyond the kitchen.